You know, for a lot of people, Bitcoin is still this kind of mystery. You hear magic internet money.
Yeah, that phrase doesn't really help, does it?
Not much. But underneath all the hype, there's this really, really sophisticated system. So today, we're doing a deep dive. We're using the sources you sent over to really explore the tech, the ideas that make Bitcoin work, going beyond just the surface stuff.
Right. Our mission here is really to demystify it. Not just the what, but the how. How do these pieces actually fit together? And crucially, why does it even matter? What's fascinating here is the detail.
Exactly. So whether you're prepping for something, just catching up, or maybe you're just curious, this should give you that core understanding and hopefully some, surprising facts without feeling totally overwhelmed. Okay, let's unpack this. So first off, what is Bitcoin? Fundamentally, it's not just a digital coin, is it? It feels bitter.
That's a great way to put it. It's really an ecosystem. Concepts, technologies, all working together. The value moves around in units we call Bitcoin, sure, but it's the system that's the main thing.
No little physical coins rattling around in cyberspace.
No, exactly. There aren't even really distinct digital objects like files you could copy. It's all about transactions, transfers of value. And you control your Bitcoin using cryptographic keys.
Keys, right, like a password.
Sort of, but much more powerful. You usually keep them in a digital wallet. These keys are mathematical proof you own the Bitcoin associated with them, and they let you sign transactions, basically give permission to spend. It puts the control squarely in your hands.
Okay, and this is where it starts getting really different from, say, dollars or euros. The economic model. Bitcoin's designed to be deflationary.
That's right, inherently deflationary. Unlike traditional currencies where a central bank can decide to print more money, Bitcoin has a hard fixed supply limit.
Which is just under 21 million.
Just under 21 million, exactly. And they won't all be created until somewhere around the year 2140.
So how does it control that creation?
Through something called the halving. It's built into the code. Roughly every 4 years, or more precisely, every 210,000 blocks of transactions added to the ledger, the reward given to miners for creating new Bitcoin gets cut in half.
Ah, so the rate of new supply slows down over time, predictably.
Predictably, that's the key. This pre-programmed scarcity means it can't just be inflated away by someone deciding to print more. Now, economists argue back and forth about deflationary money, you know, good or bad.
Right, there are debates.
Huge debates. But Bitcoin's deflation is driven purely by this fixed supply schedule. It's not like a currency collapsing because nobody wants it. It's a deliberate design choice, an experiment in digital sound money, you could say.
Makes sense. So, thinking back, before Bitcoin, trying to make digital cash without a bank was like really hard, wasn't it?
Oh, incredibly difficult. You hit these fundamental trust problems. How do you know that digital money is real, not counterfeit?
Yeah, how do you stop someone spending the same digital coin twice? That double spend problem.
Exactly. And how can you be absolutely sure the money belongs to you and only you can spend it?
So how did old systems handle it?
While traditional digital money relies on central authorities, banks, payment processors, they act as the trusted middlemen. They keep the ledger, they verify everything. There were attempts back in the late 80s, early 90s to create digital cash without these middlemen, but they tended to be centralized in other ways, making them, as the sources say, easy to attack by governments and hackers. They just couldn't crack that decentralized trust problem.
Until Satoshi Nakamoto. That 2008 white paper seems like the turning point.
Absolutely. Satoshi, whoever they are, cleverly combined several existing ideas from cryptography and distributed systems. The real genius was creating a completely decentralized system.
What was the key innovation?
Using a distributed computation system, specifically proof of work, it gets thousands of computers all over the world to agree on the state of the ledger every 10 minutes or so.
And that solves the double spending.
Elegantly, without any central controller needing to approve things. It was also a neat, practical solution to a classic computer science problem called the Byzantine Generals problem. How to get unreliable actors to agree on a single truth.
Wow. Okay, so why does that decentralization matter so much for, the average person?
Resilience, that's the big thing. No single point of failure, no central server to hack, no company headquarters to shut down. It avoids a single point of attack or corruption. It's just incredibly robust because the power and the data are spread out everywhere.
Okay, let's dig into a transaction itself. When I say send Bitcoin using my phone app, I picture coins moving from my account to someone else's. But you're saying it's not really like that under the hood.
Not at the protocol level, no. It's much more granular. The raw data doesn't actually have concepts like senders or recipients or even account balances in the way we think of them.
Really? So what is there?
Those are helpful abstractions, right? Built by wallet software, the fundamental building block, the thing that actually gets recorded, is called an unspent transaction output, a UTXO.
UTXO. Okay, what's that?
Think of it like a locked chunk of Bitcoin value. It's indivisible, and it's sitting there, available to be spent by whoever holds the key. A transaction doesn't move a coin. It consumes one or more existing UTXOs that you control.
Like using specific bills and coins from your physical wallet.
Exactly like that. You unlock them with your key, use them as inputs, and then the transaction creates new UTXOs as outputs. One output might go to the person you're paying, and if the input UTXO was worth more than the payment, another new UTXO comes back to you as change.
Ah, okay. So it's constantly consuming old UTXOs and creating new ones.
Precisely. And what's really insightful about this UTXO model is how it helps decentralization. There's no central database tracking everyone's balance. The network just needs to keep track of all the available UTXOs and verify that someone trying to spend one actually has the key. It's very efficient and robust.
Can we walk through a quick example? Say, Al's buying that coffee.
Sure. Let's say the coffee costs 0.015 Bitcoin. Alice's wallet might find a UTXO she owns that's worth, say, 0.10 Bitcoin. Maybe she received that from Joe earlier.
Okay.
Her transaction takes that 0.10 BTC UTXO as the input, then it creates two new UTXOs as outputs. One output sends 0.015 BTC to Bob's Cafe's address.
The coffee.
Right. And the second output sends the change, maybe 0.0845 BTC, back to a new address controlled by Alice.
Wait, 0.1 input, but 0.015 plus 0.0845 is only 0.0995. What happened to the rest?
Ah, good catch. That leftover bit, the 0.0005 BTC in this example, that becomes the transaction fee. It goes to the miner who eventually includes this transaction in a block.
And the fee isn't based on the 0.015 BTC value she sent.
No, and this is crucial. The fee is based on the data size of the transaction, measured in kilobytes, essentially how much space it takes up in the block.
So sending a tiny amount could still have a relatively high fee if the transaction itself is complex.
Exactly. Think about Eugenia's charity example from the sources. If she gets hundreds of tiny donations, her wallet ends up with hundreds of small UTXOs. To spend a larger amount, say, buying school books, her wallet has to bundle all those tiny UTXOs together as inputs. That makes the transaction data physically large, even if the total value isn't huge. So the fee could be significant. Managing your UTXOs becomes quite important for efficiency.
Okay, that makes sense. So these UTXOs are the value, but how do we actually control them? Let's get back to those keys. Private and public keys.
Right. This is the heart of Bitcoin security. You have a private key, which you must keep absolutely secret.
Like the key to your house.
A very, very important key. Mathematically derived from that private key is a public key. And from the public key, you derive your Bitcoin addresses, the things you share, to receive funds.
So public key and address are safe to share.
Yes. The magic here is public key cryptography, but maybe not in the way most people think. In Bitcoin, it's not primarily about encryption. It's about digital signatures.
Signatures.
Your private key lets you create a unique digital signature for a specific transaction. Anyone can use your public key to verify that signature without ever seeing your private key.
Ah, so it proves you, and only you, authorized the spending.
Exactly. You prove ownership without revealing the secret key itself.
So how do we manage all these keys? It sounds like you could end up with a lot.
You could, especially with older types of wallets. But the modern standard is the deterministic wallet, often called an HD wallet, for hierarchical deterministic.
HD wallet.
With these, all your private keys, public keys, and addresses are generated from a single starting point called a seed.
One master key, basically?
Sort of. And that seed is usually represented in a human-readable format, a mnemonic phrase. Typically 12 or 24 common English words following a standard called BIP39.
I've seen those word lists. Like, which collapse practice feed, shame open despair creek road again ice leased.
Exactly like that. Write those words down, keep them incredibly safe and offline, and you can restore your entire wallet, all your funds, on any compatible device if yours is lost or broken. It's a huge improvement over managing individual key files like in the early days.
So much safer backup.
Way safer and easier. And a quick but important warning based on the sources. Avoid paper wallets. They might sound simple, but they're now considered obsolete and quite dangerous. Prone to mistakes, damage, theft. Stick with BIP39 mnemonics, ideally secured by a hardware wallet.
Got it. Hardware wallets add another layer of security. Now, what about this extended public key or XPUB thing? You mentioned Gabriel's t-shirt store.
Right. This is a really useful feature of HD wallets. Gabriel can take just the extended public key from his wallet, not the private keys, and load it onto his web server, maybe running something like BTC Pay server.
Okay, so the server only has the public part.
Exactly. The XPUB allows the server to generate a unique new Bitcoin address for every single customer order automatically.
Without needing the private keys on that potentially less secure online server.
Precisely. The server can receive payments into addresses controlled by Gabriel's wallet, but it has no ability to spend them. The private keys that control the spending can stay safely offline, maybe on his hardware wallet.
That's clever. Separates receiving from spending.
It's a great security practice for businesses. And you mentioned vanity addresses.
Yeah, like starting with one kids or something.
They look cool, maybe easier to recognize, but the sources rightly point out it's a double-edged sword. Sure, you might recognize your vanity address, but an attacker could also generate an address that looks very similar to try and trick people sending you funds. So use with caution.
Right. Okay, we've got keys, wallets, transactions. How does this all get communicated? What is the network itself like?
Imagine this huge global mesh of computers, thousands of them, all running Bitcoin software. That's the peer-to-peer network, totally decentralized.
Are all these computers doing the same thing?
Not quite. There are different types of nodes. The most important are full nodes. These are the real workhorses. They download and store a complete copy of the entire blockchain, the whole transaction history. And crucially, they independently verify every single transaction and block against the network rules.
They enforce the rules.
Exactly. Then you have light nodes or SPV nodes. Think of mobile wallets. They don't store the whole blockchain. That would be too much data. They store only block headers and use clever cryptographic tricks like Merkle paths to verify transactions with help from full nodes, but without having to trust them completely.
So they rely on full nodes, but still have some verification.
Yeah, it's a probabilistic verification. Both types are essential for the network's health and accessibility.
How does a new computer joining the network find others to connect to?
It usually starts by querying some hard-coded DNS seeds domain names that return lists of IP addresses of active Bitcoin nodes. Once it finds a few, it connects via standard TCP and does a little handshake. They exchange version messages to check compatibility, software versions, stuff like that.
Is the communication secure? Private?
Initially, Bitcoin traffic was just plain text, not encrypted, which isn't ideal for privacy. While you can route traffic through Tor for anonymity, there's ongoing work like BIP 150 and 151 mentioned in the sources to add optional peer-to-peer authentication and encryption directly into the protocol. This helps protect light clients especially and prevents certain network attacks.
And nodes keep track of transactions that haven't been confirmed yet.
Right. They maintain a mempool, a memory pool of valid, unconfirmed transactions waiting to be picked up by miners. Sometimes an orphan pool for transactions whose inputs haven't shown up yet. And importantly, the UTXO pool, which is the current database of all those spendable, unspent transaction outputs we talked about.
Got it. Okay, that brings us to the blockchain itself, the big public ledger. And the miners who build it. How does that process actually work and create trust?
This is where proof of work, or POW, comes in. It's the consensus mechanism. Miners all around the world are in a constant race. They gather transactions from the mempool.
The ones waiting to be confirmed.
Exactly. They bundle them into a potential new block. Then they start performing a computationally intensive task, trying to find a specific number called a nonce.
A random number?
Basically, yes. They hash the block's header data along with this nonce over and over, changing the nonce each time, until they find a hash result that is numerically below a certain target value set by the network.
So it's like a lottery, but based on computing power?
A computationally expensive lottery, yes. Finding that nonce is difficult and requires a lot of processing power, hence energy. But it's easy for anyone else on the network to verify that the winning nonce is correct. That successful hash is the proof of work.
And that work, that energy spent, is what secures the ledger.
That's the core idea. Because it costs so much real-world energy and specialized hardware, ASICs, to find that proof of work, it becomes prohibitively expensive for anyone to go back and try to change past transactions. Once a transaction is included in a block, and then several more blocks are built on top of it.
The standard is usually 6 confirmations, right?
Mm-hmm.
About an hour.
Conventionally, yes. After about 6 blocks, the transaction is considered practically immutable. Reversing it would require remining those 6 blocks, plus catching up to the rest of the network, which would take an astronomical amount of energy, likely more than the original miner spent.
So what's actually in a block? You mentioned the header.
Right. The block header is key. It contains several pieces of information. Firstly, the hash of the previous block's header. That's what links the blocks together into a chain.
The chain in blockchain.
Precisely. It also contains a Merkle root. This is a clever cryptographic summary, like a fingerprint, of all the individual transactions included within that block.
So you don't need to list every transaction in the header itself?
No. The Merkle root efficiently summarizes potentially thousands of transactions into just one short 32-byte hash. It's incredibly efficient for verification. The header also has a timestamp, the current difficulty target we mentioned, and of course, the winning nonce that the miner found.
And you said the difficulty adjusts to keep blocks roughly 10 minutes apart.
Yes, automatically. Every 2016 blocks, which is designed to be about 2 weeks, the network looks back at how long it actually took to mine those blocks. If it was faster than 10 minutes per block on average, the difficulty target gets harder. If it was slower, it gets easier. It's a self-regulating system.
Clever. And how do miners get paid for all this work?
Through the Coinbase transaction. This is always the very first transaction in every single block. It's special because it doesn't have traditional inputs. Instead, it allows the winning miner to claim two things. First, the block reward, the newly created Bitcoin.
Which halves every 210,000 blocks.
Exactly. And second, all the transaction fees from all the other transactions included in that block.
Ah, so that fee Alice paid earlier goes to the miner.
Correct. And a fun fact from the sources, Satoshi put a message in the Coinbase transaction of the very first block, the Genesis block. It was a headline from the Times newspaper. Chancellor on brink of second bailout for banks.
Wow, a timestamp and maybe a little commentary there.
Seems likely. And as mining got more competitive, miners needed more space to search for nonces. They actually started using part of that flexible Coinbase transaction data field, the extra nonce space, to give their specialized ASIC hardware more room to work, increasing their chances of finding the winning hash.
It's an arms race. Mm-hmm. And since it's so hard now, most individuals can't really mine effectively on their own, right?
Not really, no. That's why mining pools became dominant. Lots of individual miners pool their hashing power together. They all work on finding the next block under the direction of a pool server, which runs the full node and coordinates things. When the pool finds a block, the reward is shared amongst the participants based on how much work they contributed. Makes it much more predictable income for smaller miners.
Okay, so the network runs, miners build a chain,
mm-hmm.
but things don't always go perfectly smoothly. What about these forks we hear about?
Right. Sometimes, just by chance, two different miners might find a valid block at almost exactly the same time.
So the network briefly disagrees on which block is next.
Exactly. Different parts of the network might see one block first, others see the second. This creates a temporary split or fork in the chain. You have two competing valid chains for a short period.
How does that get resolved?
The rule is simple. Miners always build on top of the longest valid chain. They see the one with the most accumulated proof of work. So as soon as the next block is found, whichever chain it gets added to becomes longer, the nodes running the shoulder chain will then realize theirs is orphaned, discard it, those become stale blocks, and switch over to the now longer winning chain.
And this usually happens quickly.
Very quickly, usually within one or two block times, so maybe 10, 20 minutes max. The network automatically recon converges on a single history.
Okay, that's a temporary fork. What about hard forks and soft forks? Those sound more permanent.
They can be. These relate to changes in the Bitcoin protocol's rules. A hard fork is a rule change that is not backward compatible. Older nodes that haven't upgraded will see the new blocks created under the new rules as invalid. If enough people adopt the new rules, it can permanently split the network and the currency into two separate blockchains.
Like Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash, for example.
That was a prominent example, yes. A soft fork, on the other hand, is a backward compatible rule change. The new rules are stricter, so blocks created under the new rules still look valid to old nodes, even if they don't fully understand or enforce the new constraints.
How do they manage activating soft forks without splitting the network?
Through signaling. Miners can use bits in the block headers they mine to signal their readiness to enforce the new soft fork rules, like using the BIP9 standard mentioned. Once a large enough majority signals readiness, the new rules activate for everyone. It ensures broad consensus before a change happens.
Makes sense. Now, what about this scary-sounding 51% attack?
Ah, yes, the classic theoretical attack. If a single entity or cooperating group could somehow gain control of more than 50% of the entire network's hashing power.
Which would be incredibly difficult and expensive for Bitcoin now.
Astronomically so. But if they did, they could theoretically do some damaging things. They could prevent specific transactions from getting confirmed. They could potentially double spend their own Bitcoin, like Mallory buying Carol's painting, letting the transaction confirm, then releasing a longer secret chain they mined where that payment never happened, effectively reversing the payment after getting the painting.
But they couldn't steal Bitcoin from random people's addresses.
No, they can't create fake transactions without the private keys, nor can they change old blocks easily due to the accumulated proof of work. The main risk is censoring transactions or reversing their own recent transactions. But again, the cost and difficulty are immense and increase the more confirmations a transaction has.
Okay, so possible, but highly impractical for a large network. Let's shift to some more advanced features. Time locks. What do they enable?
Time locks are really cool. They allow you to create transactions where the funds can only be spent after a certain time has passed or after a specific block number has been reached. There are absolute time locks in lock time and relative ones. Check lock, verify CLTV, check sequence verify CSV.
What's the way?
They are fundamental building blocks for more complex interactions on Bitcoin things, often called smart contracts, though simpler than on platforms like Ethereum. Think payment channels, escrow arrangements, things like that.
And segregated witness, or SegWit, that was a big upgrade, right?
Huge. It was a major architectural change implemented as a soft fork. It primarily did two things. First, it fixed something called transaction malleability. Before SegWit, a third party could slightly alter a transaction's ID before it was confirmed, which caused problems for layered protocols. SegWit fixed that by moving the signature data, the witness, outside the main transaction data used to calculate the ID.
Making transaction IDs stable.
Exactly. Second, by moving that witness data, it effectively increased the block size limit, allowing more transactions per block, improving scalability. It also paved the way for new address formats like BIC32, which are more efficient and have better error detection.
Okay, and that brings us to things built on top of Bitcoin, like the Lightning Network. These are off-chain solutions.
Right. SegWit's fixes were crucial for Lightning. The Lightning Network uses payment channels to allow for potentially millions of transactions to happen between parties without every single one needing to be recorded on the main Bitcoin blockchain.
How does that work without the blockchain security?
It uses clever cryptography and those time locks we mentioned. Basically, two parties lock some Bitcoin into a special funding transaction on the main blockchain. This opens a channel between them. Then they can send Bitcoin back and forth between themselves instantly just by updating the balance within that channel off-chain. They sign transactions representing the current state but don't broadcast them. Only when they want to close the channel do they broadcast the final state transaction to the blockchain to settle up.
What stops someone from cheating, like broadcasting an old state where they had more money?
That's where things like hash time locked contracts, HTLCs, and revocation keys come in. If someone tries to broadcast an old invalid state, the other party has a window of time to broadcast a special transaction that penalizes the cheater and gives the honest party all the funds in the channel. There are strong incentives not to cheat.
Wow. And Lightning can route payments across multiple people.
Yeah.
Like Alice paying Eric through Bob and Carol.
Exactly. It uses a kind of onion routing, similar to Tor. Each intermediary node only knows the node before and after it in the path, not the original sender or final recipient. This allows for a network of channels, enabling payments between people who don't have a direct channel open, all happening nearly instantly and with very low fees.
So Lightning sits on top of Bitcoin, using its security but allowing for much faster, cheaper payments for smaller amounts.
That's the idea. Bitcoin's main chain acts as the final settlement layer, the ultimate source of truth, while Lightning provides a scalable layer for frequent, smaller transactions.
So wrapping this all up, what's the big picture for someone listening? All these pieces, the keys, UTXOs, mining, layers like Lightning, what does it enable?
It means Bitcoin isn't just digital cash. These fundamental building blocks, the decentralized consensus, the cryptographic proofs, the programmability with time locks, they allow for much more. Think digital notary services, time stamping, secure crowdfunding, truly global and scalable payment systems, all built on a foundation that doesn't require trusting a central party.
We've definitely gone deep today, peeling back those layers.
Yeah.
From the keys literally in your digital wallet to this globe-spanning network of miners and nodes. It's fascinating how it all locks together. The crypto, the economics, the distributed agreement.
It really is. And that's the core takeaway, I think. Bitcoin was this profound breakthrough in distributed computing. How to get verified reliable trust, mathematically enforced trust, without needing a middleman. It's fundamentally about empowering you, the user, with the ability to verify things independently and control your own digital assets.
But that power comes with responsibility,
yeah.
Right? Securing those keys we talked about is paramount.
Absolutely crucial. And the risks highlighted in the sources regarding centralized exchanges or systems that look like Bitcoin but don't have its core decentralized security, those are really important reminders. Understanding these fundamentals helps you see why holding your own keys using the real network actually matters. And maybe a final thought to leave you with. We've seen how Bitcoin combines these powerful ideas, open source, cryptography, game theory. What other kinds of applications, maybe things we haven't even thought of yet beyond just money, could we build using these tools? Especially in a world that seems increasingly hungry for verifiable truth and systems we don't have to blindly trust, we've really only just begun to explore what's possible when knowledge itself can be open, accessible, and mathematically verified by anyone.